Part 1. Case Facts. Assault of Edward Lynch. In the summer of 1967, 16-year-old Edward Lynch was working as a dishwasher and cook at one of the KFCs that John Wayne Gacy was managing in Waterloo, Iowa. He consciously and unashamedly hired mostly teenage boys and justified it by saying that they worked harder for less money than anyone else. Ironically, he paid them 2 to 3 times as much as they would have earned elsewhere, which did not go unnoticed. Inspired by the serial killer Dean Corll, Gacy set up a social club in his basement and invited his favorite boys to enjoy it. He stocked the refrigerator with drinks, offered them drugs, showcased his pornography collection, and challenged them to a few rounds of pool. While the community blindly trusted Gacy for his wit and managerial vibes, what they did not realize is that their sons were spending time in the basement of a sadistic sexual predator who would do anything to get in their pants. Usually, he upped the stakes of each round of pool, with the final prize being oral sex for whoever won the game. If the boys reacted negatively to the suggestion, he resorted to gaslighting them and teased them for thinking he was serious. As it so happened, Edward Lynch was not yet part of Gacy's little boys' club when he was invited over, so he had no idea what to expect. Marlon, Gacy's wife, had just given birth to their second child, Christine, and was stuck in hospital, recovering for the night. Instead of supporting her and welcoming his daughter to the world, he decided that this was the perfect opportunity to have his way with a young boy and convince Lynch to come and check out the place. He offered him bottomless drinks, played some music, and challenged him to a few rounds of pool, of course, eventually putting his prize up for grabs. Whether Gacy lost or let Lynch win, only he ever knew. But when the game was over, his demeanor changed into the monster that he was later known to be. Nobody was allowed to refuse an offer that he made, and when Lynch did, he was infuriated. He marched him up the stairs and grabbed a carving knife as they passed the kitchen, aggressively directing him into his bedroom. He pushed him onto the bed, and the pair struggled for a while, until Gacy noticed that he had sliced the boy's left arm open. He stopped, apologized, and fetched a bandage to mend his wound. He suggested that they return to the basement to relax and watch some pornography together, and even though Lynch said that he really just wanted to get going, Gacy insisted. Fearing him, Lynch obliged, and the pair sat watching stag films in silence in the basement. Soon enough, Gacy was inspired to play a new game, where he suddenly directed him to sit down on a chair and have his hands chained behind his back and to see if he could get them loose. This would become his standard handcuff trick in later years, which he performed on almost all his victims. When Lynch could not free his hands, Gacy slithered onto his lap and rubbed his thighs delicately, which made him flinch in disgust. The heavy-set predator dropped to the floor, got up, angrily pulled out a makeshift bed, and pushed Lynch down onto it, securing his feet together with a chain. Then, he strangled him. Lynch urinated, and then, feeling his life drain out of him, decided to play dead, which ended up saving his life. It stopped Gacy in his tracks, and he tapped the boy's face repeatedly and asked if he was all right. Gacy struggled with fainting spells, seizures, and blackouts throughout his life. So, perhaps this triggered a fragment of concern or empathy in a rare moment. When Lynch eventually opened his eyes, Gacy apologized and offered him a ride home, instructing him to never talk about the incident with anyone. Of course, a few days later, he fired him. Donald Voorhees. Gacy lured 15-year-old Donald Voorhees, one of his KFC employees, to his home in August of 1967 by offering him a night of booze and pornography, something that few curious pubescent boys would be able to refuse. Once there, Gacy gave him plenty to drink and told him that he was conducting a study on sexuality, known as the Kinsey Report, twisting an actual study on sexual behavior into his own devious scheme to groom him. He told Voorhees that the study proved that most American men under the age of 35 had their first sexual experience with another male, and that it was perfectly normal. He then offered to pay him $50 to assist him in his own research, and that he would interview him after each experience to see how he felt about it. To some, this would seem like an easy offer to turn down, but in a developing teenager's mind, it's far easier to consent to something that is not fully understood for what it is yet. Gacy was an experienced groomer, and he gently nudged his victims in the direction that he wanted them to go, abusing his power as their manager, employer, and supplier of booze and or drugs. Voorhees followed Gacy's instructions and ended up performing oral sex on him, and then allowed him to return the favor to see how it would feel. He answered the research questions presented to him while he was numbed with whiskey and vodka and had his boundaries pushed with each escalating occasion. As one might expect, Gacy stayed completely sober throughout the whole experience, taking his victim to a motel, his house, and various locations for several weeks, often giving Voorhees some extra cash or gifts when he felt that he really deserved it. Eventually, Gacy was pressuring Voorhees into anal sex, which the boy felt extremely uncomfortable with and verbalized. He sensed that Voorhees might expose him and threatened to unleash his organized crime contacts to deal with him if he ever told anyone about the research that they had performed together. One afternoon, in March of 1968, Voorhees was hanging out with none other than Edward Lynch, and the pair struck up an awkward conversation about their manager, which resulted in them realizing that they were not alone in their suffering. They decided to tell their dads about it. Voorhees Sr. happened to be someone who worked with Gacy at the local Jaycees, and when he heard what Gacy had been doing to his son, he immediately reported him to the police and filed a case against him for sodomy and assault, which launched a formal investigation. Lynch and Voorhees were called in to give their statements, and upon further investigation, the police found that there were other boys that had similar experiences with Gacy. He was charged with oral sodomy of Donald Voorhees and the attempted assault of Edward Lynch, something which Gacy immediately denied and called foul play on. Voorhees Sr. was one of the members of the Iowa Jaycees who was not in support of him becoming the president, so Gacy said that the charges were politically driven. He demanded a polygraph test so that he could prove his innocence, which the police allowed, but he failed it. He took a second test with a private company and failed that too. However, some JC members believed Gacy and rallied in support of his innocence. On May the 10th, 1968, Gacy was indicted on the sodomy charges against him. He knew that he would be screwed if Voorhees testified against him in court, so he decided to intimidate him to better his chances of avoiding jail time. One of his employees, 18-year-old Russell Schroeder, was a basketball and football player and someone that Gacy often hung out with, and oddly had never propositioned for sex. Perhaps he looked up to him in some way or saw Schroeder as his equal. He offered to settle his debt on his car, $300, if he would be willing to beat up a kid who was spreading lies about him that had legal consequences. Schroeder wasn't sure at first, but after a fight with his girlfriend was pumped up for a fight and headed straight for Voorhees' high school, waiting for him to finish his classes that day. He introduced himself as a big brother, which was a mentorship type of program on the school schedule, and offered to take him for a ride out to a beautiful spot in the country where they could kick back and have some drinks together. Voorhees did not hesitate, once again lured by the promise of alcohol, and the pair drove out to an isolated park in September of 1968. When they got there, Schroeder sprayed him with mace and beat him up, making up a story about Voorhees stealing a car from somebody. When he denied it, Schroeder apologized and said he would drive him home. As he got up, he sprayed him in the face with mace again, and this time he also hit him with a stick. Voorhees wiped his eyes and ran into the surrounding cornfields, where he managed to hide from his attacker until he left. He ran to a nearby farmhouse and called the police, who did not believe him until they came to the scene and saw the signs of struggle. Voorhees identified Schroeder from a photograph, and the police called the boy in for questioning. He made up a story and denied ever using mace, trying his level best to stick to his story. Eventually, he cracked under the pressure and told the police that Gacy had offered to pay him $300 to intimidate Voorhees. This led to Gacy's arrest, with the additional charge of hiring someone to assault a witness in his trial. On September the 12th, Gacy was ordered to undergo a full psychiatric evaluation at the University of Iowa's Psychiatric Hospital, where he spent 17 days. Two doctors observed him for the entire period, studying him in depth and concluding that he had antisocial personality disorder and would likely not benefit from any therapy or medical treatment. They also noted that his behavioral patterns would likely always lead to conflict in society, concluding that he was fit to stand trial. He scored an IQ of 118, which was in the bright to normal range, and never once accepted responsibility for any of his actions, instead stubbornly shifting the blame onto everything and everyone else, especially his victims. On November the 7th, 1968, Gacy faced Judge Van Meter in court, pleading guilty only to the charge against him concerning Donald Voorhees, who he said was purely an incident of curiosity and compliance to the boy's demands. However, the judge did not believe a word of Gacy's elaborate stories, and on December the 3rd, 1968, sentenced him to 10 years in prison at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. Excerpt from The Killer Clown by Terry Sullivan and Peter Makin. "The particular pattern you seem to have chosen," the judge said, "is to seek out teenage boys and get them involved either in sexual misbehavior or in other misbehaviors, and, unsatisfactory in many respects as imprisonment is, at least that will ensure for some period of time that you cannot seek out teenage boys to solicit for immoral behavior of any kind." Anamosa State Penitentiary. Gacy seemed to arrive at Anamosa State Penitentiary wearing a glowing halo, determined to prove what a decent guy he really was. This is a common pattern in groomers and abusers. They are usually the ones with the big, shiny, good guy badges proudly displayed on their chests, and Gacy exhibited exactly those behaviors. His wife had filed for divorce on the same day that he had been found guilty of his charges. The divorce was finalized in September of 1969, with a court ruling in his wife's favor for sole custody of their two children, full ownership of their house, and alimony. He never saw his wife or children again, likely also because his in-laws set a firm boundary in place to protect their daughter. They had never been fond of Gacy, and Marlon's father must have had his told-you-so moment at some point. But Gacy, ever defiant, simply said that they were dead to him and moved on with his life. In prison, he decided that the best strategy would be to stay away from any homosexuals and to use his time to work hard to get out of there as soon as possible, and to think how he could change his actions in the future. Unfortunately, his conclusions would never be any good. He realized that the only reason he got caught was because he left his victims alive to tell their tale. The seed for murder was planted as he glided through Anamosa as a model prisoner. He attached himself to a group of three men who were established friends and were known to protect each other, a smart move to stay semi-isolated while staying protected from other prisoners. He wasn't shy to talk about his charges because he twisted them to suit him. He explained that he just showed some boys pornography, which he did not know was a crime, and never once opened up about the assault or sodomy that he was actually serving time for. Gacy was so believable that nobody questioned him, often scoffing with him over the ridiculous consequences of his actions. He was assigned to work on commissary and in the kitchen, possibly because of his experience in the food industry before his arrest. The quality of the food improved drastically during his time there, something that earned him major brownie points with the staff and other inmates. He was also one of the few prisoners allowed outside of his cell until midnight because of the work that he was required to do on commissary, which gave him an elevated status amongst his peers. His work for the local JCs continued as the director of the prison chapter, where he successfully recruited 600 new members within a few months, worked on a miniature golf course for the prison yard, and dressed up as Santa Claus, which earned him a Sound Citizen Award from them. Within 6 months, he was applying for early release, which was rejected, even though his progress was acknowledged. His mother wrote the prison letters to plead for her son's release based on the deteriorating health of his father. His first request for early release was turned down, which motivated him to work even harder. He completed 16 high school courses, enrolled in 23 JC committees, and started taking college-level classes. On Christmas Day in 1969, he received the news that his father had died of cirrhosis of the liver, which devastated him. He apparently fell to the floor and sobbed, needing support from prison wardens for weeks following the news. He believed that his father had died of disappointment in him, something that his younger sister Karen tried to convince him was not true, saying that he died because of the consequences of his heavy drinking. But Gacy was convinced that the years of his own failures and the disappointment in him had killed his father. By March of 1970, during his psychiatric evaluation, Gacy said that he no longer entertained the unconventional attitudes that he once had. The doctor noted that he had a passive-aggressive personality, but that he believed he would not commit the same offenses once released. Based on his excellent grades, good performance, positive influence on other inmates, and the evaluation from several psychiatrists, he was successfully released early, after only 18 months behind bars, on June 18, 1970. Return to Chicago. On June 18, 1970, just after noon, Gacy's best friend from the Waterloo JCs, Clarence Lane, picked him up from the Anamosa State Penitentiary, excited to see him released early and advising him to stay out of trouble. "Clarence, I'll never go back to jail," Gacy said. His 12-month parole required him to go and live with his widowed mother in Chicago, adhere to a 10 p.m. curfew, and avoid engaging in any homosexual activity. When Gacy arrived at his mother's house, she had arranged a job for him at Bruno's restaurant through family friend Eugene Boschelli. Gacy thrived in the downtown restaurant environment, becoming a charismatic host and engaging with the clientele that the place attracted, which included the Blackhawks hockey team and police officers. Of course, he walked around bragging that he was the personal chef of the Blackhawks, in typical Gacy style. One of the police officers that he had met at the restaurant and evidently admired was called James Hanley. Gacy took that name and made it his own, turning himself into Jack Hanley when he was dressed up as a cop and prowling the streets for a fresh piece of meat. He rapidly settled into his new life, even dating some of the waitresses at the restaurant. But soon enough, people started to notice that he was hanging out with more and more young men after hours. He wrote two letters to his wife, requesting the pictures of his children that she had initially promised him. But after they went unanswered, told his mother that for the sake of his own sanity, it was better that he just considered them dead. They got rid of all the photographs of them in the house, and he decided to wholeheartedly move on. He got his certificate of release in October 1971, even though two incidences of homosexual activity were reported, which violated his parole. One of these incidents involved a 19-year-old who reported him to the police for sexual misconduct that took place at Gacy's house, but when Gacy filed a counter-report, the case was dropped. The other evidence of his homosexual activity while on parole involved 20-year-old Michael Reed, but because they had started a business together, all suspicions were dropped. They started offering painting and maintenance work for people that Gacy had met at the restaurant, and soon enough a small empire had formed. They ran out of space to store all of their equipment in Gacy's mother's apartment storeroom, so he pitched the grand idea of buying a bigger house together as a family. He would pay half, and his mother and sisters would be responsible for the other half. They agreed, searched for the perfect home, and settled on a ranch house at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue in Norridge, Cook County, Illinois. What his mother had not anticipated was that he was going to move his new business partner in and share a bedroom with, all for the sake of business. Another tactic that Gacy liked to fall back on to justify his deviant actions. 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. By August of 1971, they moved into the immaculate two-bedroom, two-bathroom ranch house at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, excited about the expanded space that they could share and enjoy. His new business was growing, and Gacy threw himself into the excessive work schedule that later helped to cover his depravity. One afternoon after work, he impulsively hit Reed on the back of the head with a hammer in the garage after asking him to bend down to look for screws on the floor. Blood dripped down his neck, and in agony he turned around and asked why he had done that. Gacy shrugged and said that he just had the sudden urge to kill him. Reed moved out the next day, even though he continued to work with him for a while following the incident. As if nothing happened, Gacy suddenly announced that he officially had a girlfriend, Carol Hoff, the same girl that his sisters were friends with when they were kids. She was a divorcee with two children of her own and had briefly dated John in school, so it was an easy fit for them both. He told his mother that they had been reacquainted in May of 1971 while she was finalizing her divorce, and that he was excited to be a father to her daughters. Perhaps he saw it as an opportunity to instantly regain what he had lost: a home, a wife, and two kids. The couple spent New Year's Eve of 1971 at Bruno's, the restaurant where Gacy worked, and returned to 8213 Summerdale for the night. A few weeks later, Carol told him that she was pregnant, something that Gacy expressed excitement about, but in February she unfortunately had a miscarriage. In March, he invited her and her two daughters to move in, where he chose to permanently sleep in the living room. The couple, according to Carol, mostly had sex on Friday nights when both of their mothers went out to play bingo. We can only hope that the children were always asleep in their rooms. Gacy's separation from his new family seemed carefully planned ahead of time to reduce any responsibility or expectation from him, leaving room for him to indulge in his devious activities undetected. They married on July 1, 1972, and had the reception in the backyard at the Summerdale house. Gacy had successfully built a cover life for himself within 6 months of murdering his first victim on January the 3rd, which also included launching his business, PDM Contractors, painting, decorating and maintenance, and asking his mother to move out. He resented the fact that she sometimes answered the phone for him, explaining to his clients that she was John's mother. He believed it cramped his style and limited his business, so he unashamedly kicked his mother out of the house. With one bedroom vacant after his mother's departure, one would think that Gacy and his wife could comfortably share one room, and their daughters the other. But he clearly did not want that. Instead, he invited his mother-in-law to move in to help look after the kids, which lasted 1 year before he obtained a court order to have her evicted. He expressed to police how much he disliked his mother-in-law and how he battled to force her to move out. The couple lived together without either of their mothers living at the house for approximately 2 years. During this time, the marriage had quickly declined, with Gacy prioritizing time with his circle of friends from the local Jaycees and from work. His wife noticed that he frequently invited teenage boys to hang out with him in the basement and garage until the early hours of the morning. To her horror, her suspicions about him were confirmed when she found a mattress with a red light in the garage, a mirror, stacks of gay pornography, and some wallets and identification cards, something that infuriated him when she asked him about it. She was aware of his time in prison for sodomy charges before she married him, but had sincerely believed that he was a changed man. She realized that perhaps he had not changed after all, and decided not to set foot in what was evidently the scene of his sexual exploitations of young boys in their garage. On Mother's Day in 1975, May the 11th, Gacy admitted to his wife that he identified as bisexual and that it would be the last time that they would be having sex. He murdered his second victim on July 31st, 1975, and buried the body in the crawl space, which increased the lingering odor that Carol had picked up since she had moved in. She suggested that they call an exterminator for the gnats and black bugs that crawled from below into the house, even in midwinter, but Gacy quickly proposed his own solution, blaming the dampness in the crawl space for the smell. He first had his employees spread lime all over the burials, barking orders at them as they stomped around in the mud, and later poured concrete over one section of the crawl space, which seemed to help reduce the odor. In October that year, Carol filed for divorce, a decision finally made after he had verbally abused her for incorrectly balancing one of his checkbooks. Gacy agreed to the divorce, and the couple mutually consented to her and her daughter staying there until February the following year, which is when they eventually moved out. On March the 2nd, 1976, the divorce was finalized under the false grounds of Gacy's infidelity with women, rather than his obsession with teenage boys and homosexual magazines. And Carol also expressed that she could no longer endure the mental cruelty that he subjected her to. By this time, Gacy had studied all the details of Alma Wayne Henley and Dean Corll, who were both sadistic and sexually driven serial killers, and felt inspired by some of the things that they had done. He copycatted a 2x4 torture board, which he used to sadistically rape and abuse his victims before he murdered them. He had also read all about Corll, who had raped and murdered 28 known teenage victims aged 13 to 20 between 1970 and 1973, with the help of two teenage accomplices who helped him to lure the victims to his home, usually by offering them a ride or inviting them to a party. He eerily copycatted almost every move and became the villain that he had studied and admired. Carl was also a workaholic who invited teenagers to hang out after work. He had a candy store by day and a boys' club by night, where he drank and played pool with teenage boys before luring them into his trap to kill. Gacy did precisely the same in his basement, forming his own little club, where his employees could kick back after a long day of work, play pool, and enjoy the booze and drugs that he generously offered them. Two teenage boys, David Cram and Michael Rossi, lived with Gacy and worked with him during his serial killing years. And while police believe that Gacy acted alone in every murder, they have never denied that he likely also had accomplices to help him lure victims to his home. More on this later. By mid-1977, Gacy was murdering teenage boys at the rate of approximately 2 per month, burying most of them in his crawl space and discarding of the last few in the Des Plaines River. Catching him would prove more difficult than the police had ever imagined. First search warrant. On December 11th, 1978, 15-year-old Robert Piest disappeared after his work shift at Nissen's Pharmacy, a part-time job that he had started the previous summer. Gacy was at the pharmacy twice that night to discuss remodeling plans with the owner, Phil Torf, who had become one of his many friends. On his second visit, he took notice of all the teenage staff that Torf had on deck, boasting that he too hired mostly teenage boys and that he paid them $5 per hour as a starting wage. The pair laughed, and a few more of the staff members joked about getting a job with Gacy, while Rob quietly stocked shelves in the background. Mrs. Piest arrived at the pharmacy to pick up her son at approximately 8:55 p.m., knowing that he would finish by 9 p.m. It was her 46th birthday, and the family looked forward to a wonderful meal together that night, which included a spectacular birthday cake that Rob had eyed that afternoon before starting his shift. Rob finished up his stock shelving as his mother waited and then called out to her, "Some contractor wants to talk to me about a job." Rushing out the door and promising to be right back, he was never seen again. A missing person report was filed that night. An extensive search was carried out in the area for weeks following his disappearance, and the Piest family never gave up on finding answers about what happened to Rob. When police were able to confirm from multiple sources that Gacy was the contractor that Rob Piest was going outside to talk to on December the 11th, they set out to arrange a search warrant, suspecting that he was holding Rob against his will, particularly because they had just become aware of his sodomy charges from his previous criminal records. They had visited Gacy's home on December the 12th to question him about his visits to the pharmacy the previous evening and asked him to come into the station for questioning because he was the last person known to see the boy alive. Gacy said that his uncle had died the previous evening and he had to make funeral arrangements, so he could not make it to the station with them. When they pressed him for a time that he would be available, he said, "I don't know. I'll try to be there in an hour. What's wrong with you guys anyway? Don't you have any respect for the dead?" They had agreed to meet Gacy at the station at approximately 11 p.m. that evening. By 1 a.m., officers were sent home and there was no sign of him. At 3:20 a.m., he stumbled into the station covered in mud, saying that he was late because he got involved in a car accident. On December the 13th, when he had returned to the police station to make a written statement about his activities the previous night, they presented him with a search warrant and requested the keys to his house. At first he refused, eventually handing them over, saying, "Don't get the place all messed up." Psychologists later noted that he was genuinely more concerned about police messing up the order of things than he was about the bodies he had buried beneath his house. That afternoon, on December 13, 1978, police entered Gacy's home to thoroughly search for clues of Rob's disappearance, hoping that they would find him in there alive. As they entered his home, they noticed his office, a room filled with plants, and framed clown paintings on the walls. There were two bedrooms, two bathrooms, a recreation room, kitchen, laundry, and living room to inspect, as well as two trapdoors that they spotted, one under a set of golf clubs that led to Gacy's crawl space, the other with a drop-down ladder that led to an unfinished attic. Gacy's home was extraordinarily neat and organized, with no obvious signs of wrongdoing at first glance. Throughout the house, detectives found clues to what Gacy got up to behind closed doors. Their inventory included a jewelry box containing a variety of trinkets, including a Maine West High School ring engraved with the initials JAS, several driver's licenses and wallets, pill boxes, a hypodermic needle, handcuffs, pornographic magazines and movies, sex toys, and items of clothing that were too small to fit him. In the attic, they discovered an 18-inch dildo covered in dried excrement, more pornography, and police stars and badges. Some of the books they found in the house included The Rights of Gay People, Pederasty, Sex Between Men and Boys, Tight Teenagers, and The Great White Swallow. In one of the bedrooms, they noticed the 2x4 that he had constructed with holes drilled on each end, and had also found a pistol, marijuana, and a knife. In the kitchen, one detective took note of an orange receipt from Nissen's pharmacy and bagged it as evidence, something that could certainly confirm that Gacy was responsible for Rob's disappearance. Their final search took place in the crawl space, where they looked for any signs of soil disturbance. They noticed that the ground was covered with lime, but could not find any other signs of malice. Both of Gacy's vehicles were confiscated, and two-man surveillance teams were assigned to observe him 24 hours a day while investigations were being conducted. Surveillance and civil suit. Officers Rob Schulz and Ronald Robinson, Team 1, and David Hechmeister with Mike Albrecht, Team 2, were assigned to surveil Gacy in 12-hour shifts, which included long, cold December night stakeouts at his house, high-speed car chases — Gacy was known as a reckless and fast driver — bar hops, and eventually sharing mealtimes with him to gather more information and get more acquainted with his suspect. Gacy invited them out for breakfasts, dinners, cocktails, and even drinks at his home, trying his level best to get them on his side. He was used to buying people's attention and favor, something he did since he was a young man. It was during these meetings that Gacy said on more than one occasion that clowns could get away with murder. At first, he thought they were following him for drug-related charges, but when he realized that he was the prime suspect in Rob Piest's disappearance, he became more defensive and threatened to file a civil suit against them. As the days rolled on, he looked noticeably more exhausted and disheveled, increasing his drinking habits and tried to stay as busy as possible in an attempt to get rid of the cops on his tail at all hours of the day and night. The officers got little sleep during their surveillance period, spent minimal time with their families, and sacrificed their entire lives to catch who they believed was Rob Piest's abductor, or killer. During this time, everything they had confiscated from Gacy was being investigated for traces of Piest, which included Gacy's new 1979 four-door black Oldsmobile Delta 88 and black Chevy PDM contractor's pickup truck. On December 18, 1978, he drove to his attorney, Sam Amarante's office, to draw up a $750,000 civil suit against the city of Des Plaines and several police officers, saying that they had caused damage to his business, mental health, and personal property. He complained about his reputation being ruined, deprivation of his liberty, his right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and his right to privacy. The suit had been filed in the Federal District Court. However, the police could not back down at that point. Instead, pushing for a second search warrant of Gacy's property when they learned that the receipt that they had found in the kitchen was the same one placed in Rob Pierce's jacket by his colleague, Kim, and that the JAS ring belonged to one of Gacy's previous employees, John Syke, who had been reported missing. During visits to Gacy's home, officers also caught a whiff of a smell from beneath the house because it was getting colder and Gacy had turned the heat ventilators on. It smelled like death, and they knew that they had to search the crawl space more carefully for clues. Cram and Rossi interviews. On December 20th, 1978, detectives called David Cram and Michael Rossi in separately for questioning. Both teenagers had worked for Gacy and had lived in his home at one point, so they held the key to many missing pieces in the case. For example, the car that Rossi was driving and had bought from Gacy belonged to John Syke, the teenagers whose JAS engraved ring they found in Gacy's jewelry collection and whose Motorola television they suspected was propped up in his bedroom. He had been reported missing, but due to the new hard evidence, detectives believed he was most likely dead. Rossi held his composure for over 2 hours, enjoyed a prime rib meal with detectives, and then broke down in tears before he was given a polygraph test. He told them that he thought that the car was stolen and that he had never personally knew Syke, nor had he ever assumed that he could be dead. He bought the car from Gacy and paid it off by working for him. Later that afternoon, they called David Cram in for questioning, telling him that Rossi had told them everything, a popular interrogation tactic to get a witness to talk. They told him about Syke's ring, the television in Gacy's room, the car, and that they knew that Gacy went to prison for sodomy charges before. Cram told detectives that while he stayed with Gacy, he always had to sleep in a pair of pants to avoid him trying to slip it to him in the middle of the night. Apparently, he entered Cram's room with an erection on several nights and called out in a high-pitched voice that he should know by now what he wanted. He also told them about Gacy's handcuff trick, where he once challenged him to try and get himself out of them. Seeing his sinister smile made him panic, and Gacy said, "The trick is, you gotta have the key." Thankfully, Cram managed to kick him in the stomach, grab the key, and free himself. If he hadn't, we can safely assume where his body would have been buried. When detectives turned their focus on the crawl space, Cram told him that he had been down there before to cover the ground with lime, and another time to dig some trenches. This statement piqued their interest, and they carefully pressed for more information. He told them that Gacy asked him to dig 3 trenches that were approximately 2 feet deep and 2 feet wide, and that he was to strictly avoid a mound of dirt that was about the size of the tabletop that they were sitting at. They asked if he had ever seen any other mounds of dirt, which he said he had. When officers were searching Gacy's house the previous week, Cram said that Gacy was visibly anxious about them going into the attic or the crawl space, even asking him to go and check the attic for him, which he refused to do. When Gacy spotted mud on the carpet once officers had left, he panicked and went into the crawl space to check if they had done any digging. Cram told him that Gacy was meticulous about everything in his house, including the crawl space, and had special boots to wear when he descended into it, which he kept right at the entrance. By 9 p.m., Rossi had asked officers to accompany him back to his apartment, fearful of his manager at that point. When they got there, Gacy was indeed waiting for him and demanded that any further conversations he had with the police had to be in the presence of his lawyer. He spoke with Rossi for approximately 15 minutes and then headed back out, telling the surveillance officers, Schultz and Robinson, that they could prepare for a long drive ahead. They followed him to Sam Amarante's office in Park Ridge, letting Hechmeister and Albrechner wait to meet them to start the next surveillance shift. They had all assumed that Gacy would be meeting with his lawyer to further finalize his civil suit against them. Little did they know that he was about to confess to more than 30 murders. When Bob Schultz got home that evening and sat thinking about the day and all the information he had learnt, he realized exactly what he smelled coming from the air vent in Gacy's washroom. It was the smell of death. Confession and arrest. At first, officers were told that Gacy would only be with his attorney for approximately 15 minutes. So when there was no sign of him hours later, they decided to investigate his whereabouts. Sure enough, he was still inside with Sam Amarante, his attorney and friend. During this time, he had asked Amarante for a drink and was given some whiskey. Gacy picked up a copy of the Daily Herald on his desk, pointed to a front-page article about the disappearance of Rob Piest, and said, "This boy is dead. He's in a river." He then gave a rambling, monologue confession to 30-plus murders, saying that he had been the judge, jury, and executioner of many, many people, and that he wanted to be the same for himself. Amarante learned that Gacy had, in fact, buried almost all of his victims in the crawl space because he believed that they were his property, and that he had thrown five of his latest victims in the Des Plaines River. He said that all the murders were justified because the kids were male prostitutes, hustlers, liars, and runaways. He felt that he was doing society a service while simultaneously getting off on what he was doing. And he told him how they had practically killed themselves by falling for his rope and handcuff tricks. At one point, he said that their convulsions after strangulation caused their deaths, which in his twisted mind meant that they had killed themselves and he was innocent of the crimes. He drank so much whiskey that he passed out during his confession and lay snoring on a bench in Amarante's office. Surveillance officers had no idea of the content that Gacy had just shared with his attorneys, but could sense that there was tension in the air at that point. Amarante had arranged a psychiatric evaluation for Gacy at 9 a.m., but when he woke up and was reminded what he had confessed to, he shook his head and said, "Well, I can't think about this right now. I've got important things to do," before rushing out of the building and speeding off in his car. Surveillance officers followed him to a Shell gas station, where he handed the young fuel attendant a bag of freshly rolled cannabis, patted him on the back and said, "We've been friends. You're like a brother. I can't take much more." When he walked back to his car, officers approached the young man, who quickly handed them the bag and told them that Gacy was acting crazy. He had told them, "The end is coming for me. These guys are going to kill me," before walking off, something that the officers found very strange. Next, they followed him to Ronald Rhodes' house, one of Gacy's fellow contractors and someone he had considered a friend. He gave him a hug and had tears in his eyes, whispering to his friend that he had been a bad boy and killed 30 people, give or take a few. He left in tears, wiping his eyes and ignoring Rhodes' request for him to calm down and come back inside. He drove back towards the gas station and stopped there one more time, where he again approached the young fuel attendant to say goodbye. He got back in the car and drove to Michael Rossi's house, clutching a rosary and swaying the car from side to side in tears and desperation. Officers were starting to get worried that Gacy was going to kill himself and decided that they needed to arrest him as soon as possible. They followed them to a restaurant, where all four surveillance officers met for a shift change, and Gacy had gone to meet with his lawyer again. Rossi came out to talk to them at one point, saying that Gacy had been popping pills all morning, was very depressed, and that he had just confessed to killing more than 30 people in the presence of his lawyers. The officers were shocked at the news, suddenly realizing why he had been acting so erratic all morning and saying such strange things. Gacy was adamant that he wanted to go and visit his father's grave and wanted to take Rossi with him. Rossi told officers that he feared that he would kill him and then himself out there, so they knew they had to act quickly. They cornered him just after midday on December 21st and arrested him for possession and distribution of marijuana, saying, "We've got you now, you jagoff." Jagoff was, according to his ex-wife and the officers, one of Gacy's least favorite words, a trigger word, if you will. And while it had upset him many times before, this time he was meek and helpless in the moment. What's all this about? Hey, we're friends. We've come a long way. Can't you level with me?" he skulked. Amarante met them at the police station, furious that they were still harassing Gacy, and confirmed that the civil suit would be in federal district court the following day. The pressure to get a second search warrant was immense, and everyone hoped that they would be able to get it before the civil suit Gacy had filed against them got in their way. In the meantime, their murder suspect had grabbed his chest and seemed to be having a seizure. Paramedics were rushed to the scene, and he was wheeled off to the Holy Family Hospital in Des Plaines, where doctors thoroughly examined him while officers guarded him. As it turned out, there was no evidence of a heart attack, seizure, or any medical abnormality, and medical staff diagnosed him with next-level bullshitting. Second search warrant. At 4:30 p.m. on December 21st, Judge Marvin J. Peters signed the search warrant and an entire squad of detectives and police officers rushed to 8213 West Summerdale Avenue. When he heard the news, he immediately went into the defense, telling them that he had nothing to do with Rob Pierce's disappearance, even though he had once killed a boy in self-defense and buried him under his garage. When they arrived at the house, they saw that Gacy had unplugged his sump pump and had purposely flooded the crawl space to sabotage the investigation. They plugged it back in and waited for the water to drain, which only took about 10 minutes, but was said to have felt like hours. While they waited, they were finally able to run the serial number of the television in Gacy's bedroom and confirm that it was the same one John Sykes' mother had reported as stolen when her son had gone missing. Gacy had a missing boy's television in his bedroom, which was another big breakthrough in the case. They also found a variety of identification cards, watches, pieces of jewelry, and other items that did not belong to John Wayne Gacy. Once the water was sufficiently drained, evidence technician E.T. Daniel Genty and investigator Phil Bettiker made their way down into the 28 by 38 foot, 8.5 by 11.6 meter muddy crawl space, wearing boots, coveralls, and thick waterproof gloves. They crawled to the wet and spongy southwesternmost corner and carefully started digging. Within minutes, Genty shouted, "Charge him, I found one," showing the officers the bit of hair and flesh on his shovel and plucking out what appeared to be a human arm bone. "I think this place is full of kids," he said, crawling to another corner in the crawl space to confirm it. After a few shovels, he struck something solid again. This time, it was a patella, kneecap. In the third corner, he dug up two leg bones that had turned completely black, realizing that some bodies had been there for quite some time, while others were more recently buried there. The ones they had found at that point were too decomposed to belong to Rob Piest, which was the only body that they were initially looking for. Based on the number of bodies that they now assumed would be down there, it was decided that the crawl space needed to be treated like an archaeological dig to preserve as much as possible of the remains for identification purposes. This would become one of the most important and tedious tasks the team had ever completed, one that required strong stomachs and lots of humor to make it through each day. Murder, confessions, and arrest. Just after 10 p.m. on December 21, 1978, Gacy was released from the hospital into the hands of the surveillance team, who drove him back to the police station. Officer Dave Hechmeister had waited a long time for this moment, plucking Gacy out of the car in the secure police garage and shouting, "Okay, you jagoff, the game is over. You're under arrest for murder. We found bodies." Gacy was strip-searched for drugs and given a police uniform to wear while he clutched his rosary, mumbling that he knew it was over since the night before when he confessed to his lawyers. When they had settled down, he asked, "Have you been in the crawl space?" They nodded yes, and then he explained the reason for the lime that he had scattered down there, to reduce the odor of the rotting bodies he had buried there and wanted to forget all about. He told them that he had scattered approximately 800 pounds of lime in the crawl space, which was a substantial amount, hoping it would drown out the smell of rotting flesh. His Miranda rights were read to him, which he signed, and then he was taken in for formal questioning. "Dave, I want to clear the air," he said. "I know that the game is over. The lime was used to cover the smell. The bodies have been down there a long time. And there are more bodies off the property." He confirmed that they would not be able to find Rob Pierce's body in the crawl space or on his property, revealing that he had discarded of at least five victims in the Des Plaines River. When asked why he had killed his victims, he told officers that he considered himself bisexual, not homosexual, and said, "I never use force. It was always by consent. I never forced anybody because I'm not strong enough to fight, especially with my heart condition." He then asked them if they had also arrested his associates, referring to David Cram and Michael Rossi, and later saying that he had four personalities, one who hated homosexuals. When they pressed for more information about why he killed them, he said, "Because the boys sold their bodies for $20. They killed themselves." When asked why he didn't bury all the bodies in the crawl space, Gacy snorted that the crawl space was full and that his heart condition prevented him from digging any more graves. He then turned to Officer Albrecht and said, "Mike, you know I won't be in jail for very long. I won't spend a day in jail for this," confident that the murders would not be directly tied to him or that he would win an insanity defense with the help of his lawyers. His lawyer, Sam Amarante arrived at the police station after being told to leave Gacy's house, which he had visited to figure out what the fuss was all about. When he spoke to the officers, he was shocked to learn that the information that Gacy had given him the previous night under the influence of alcohol was literally true. They had found the bodies. At 3:30 a.m. on December 22, 1978, Gacy began his official confession in the presence of four surveillance officers, Schultz, Hechmeister, Albrecht, and Robinson. He told them his modus operandi, discard process, and the details of his final victim's murder, Rob Piest. He said that the boy had run up to his car on December 11th and said that he would do almost anything to make money, with Gacy adding that the boy had lied, referring to him obviously not wanting to have sexual interactions with him. When Rob wanted to leave and said the words, "Gee, I thought you were going to kill me," Gacy realized that he could not let him go in case he talked about his experience and exposed him. So he decided to kill him by strangling him with a rope like the other victims. He slept next to his body all night, moved it to the attic the next day, and discarded of it on December 13th when he had his car accident. He got stuck in the mud on the way home after dumping Pierce's body. He confessed to murdering more than one victim on the same night on some occasions, calling it doubles, and explained how effective his Jack Hanley police officer persona was in getting boys to go home with him. According to him, he never bothered straight people, never pressed for anything beyond oral sex, and that the pornographic content they found in his house were not his and was only used to stimulate some of his victims. All but two victims, including Piest, he said, died between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., because he had developed a routine for his cruising or hunting. Mike Albrecht scribbled down everything that Gacy had told them, and his confession was completed just before sunrise that morning. Once they were done, they drove Gacy 50 miles to the location where he said he discarded off five victims' bodies. It was from Smith's Bridge over the Des Plaines River on the Interstate 55, or I-55. Officers held onto Gacy's arms as he looked down and showed them where he dropped their bodies down for a 40-foot fall into the cold water below. When they knew where they would begin their search for the five bodies, they headed back to 8213 Summerdale Avenue with him so that he could indicate the location of the victim that he had buried in the garage. On arrival, Gacy was visibly agitated that his garage was in disarray, fumbling with tools and cans of paint on his shelves to put everything back in order. They urged him to show them where he had buried the body, so he grabbed a can of orange spray paint and made a large X on the floor. "Dig there," he barked. When asked if he knew the victim's name, he answered, "John Butkovich," detailing how he had buried him with his head facing towards the south. Interestingly, when Gacy was on death row before his execution, he told his interviewer, CBS2's Walter Jacobson, that Butkovich was not one of the ones he killed. It seems that he got to the point of wholeheartedly believing in his own lies, which is common in incarcerated serial killers, even though he had led police to the body a decade and a half before. Gacy grabbed a sledgehammer and started whacking the spot that he had just marked. Officers stopped him and ensured him that they would be responsible for the digging, leading him into the house so that he could check on his plants and his dog, which he had shown concern about. He was furious when he spotted muddy footprints on his carpet and his house, shouting at evidence technicians and police officers for making a mess of his house. He was cuffed and taken back to the station. The crawl space. Gacy was legally detained at the Des Plaines Police Department based on his previous criminal records, confession, and the presence of human remains in his crawl space. He had also marked the spot of one of his burial sites, which denied him the bail that he sought out. Officers questioned him thoroughly, frequently reading him his Miranda rights, which he could eventually recite off by heart. Officer Mike Albrecht asked him if he was able to recall precisely where he had buried the bodies of all of his victims, to which Gacy answered that he needed a pen and paper to draw a diagram for him. He created a neatly drawn diagram of the crawl space and the grave sites of his victims, saying that some trenches contained more than one body. On death row, he said that his drawing had been fabricated and that he did not commit any of the murders that he was being charged with. He was in jail, waiting to be transferred to Surmac, a wing in the Cook County prison, and begged incessantly to visit his father's grave one last time. Officers were able to talk him out of it, fearing that he would complete suicide at the site, by telling him that the press would be stomping all over his father's grave if he went there. "Look at them. They're like a pack of dogs chasing a bone," he said, agitated, but reveling in the limelight. He was finally the center of attention. After 13 days of surveillance, the exhausted team of police officers handed him over to the Cook County prison wardens on December 23, 1978, just before noon. What started as the hunt for one boy turned into one of the biggest investigations in Des Plaines' history. The crawl space had to be treated with extreme care to ensure that no evidence was lost, and all remains would have to be precisely exhumed and measured. It was divided into quadrants to account for every inch of soil and its contents, and it was decided that the best strategy would be to remove the flooring of the house to access it without exposing it to the weather or the public. Evidence technicians Daniel Genty and Cole Humbert started digging where they found the kneecap, but soon realized that their tools damaged the remains and made the job virtually impossible with the muddy water. It would have to be done by hand. Their surgical gloves proved too fragile for the job, so they invested in thick rubber gloves, securing them with tape to prevent any slime and flesh from getting into them. They grabbed handfuls of mud and put it into buckets, handing them to the team above to rinse and filter. Those teams also had to get gloves to prevent the lime that Gacy had scattered from stinging their skin, and bit by bit, the crawl space was excavated. Few bodies remained intact, so bones and other pieces of evidence had to be carefully numbered and mapped out so that they could keep track of the remains. On the first day, they had recovered one full body and part of another. By the second day, they realized that some graves contained more than one body at different levels, and sometimes it meant that the bones had intermingled. This greatly increased the exhumation challenge, where each grave's findings had to be measured in height before digging deeper to see if there were more remains to discover. And often, there were more remains to discover. Each body was given an identification number in the order that they were discovered. Example, body 1, body 2, etc. 5 victims' remains were recovered before Christmas. The team took a break on Christmas Day and continued the next day when 4 more were extracted. On December 27th, 8 more bodies were found, and on December 28th, 4 more. By December 29th, 6 bodies were extracted, which totaled 26 victims' remains found in the crawl space and 1 from the garage. The team took a much-needed break over New Year's, which is also when it started snowing heavily. It froze the ground and prevented any more work from being done. The Chicago Blizzard of 1979 took place between January 13th and 14th, which was one of the largest snowstorms in Chicago's history at the time. They were only able to resume work on March the 9th, when another body was found wrapped in plastic and buried near Gacy's barbecue pit, even though he insisted that they would not find any more remains. On March 16th, the final and 29th body was found buried under the dining room floor. Police also found pornography, sex toys, drugs, and other items hidden in the walls and secret pockets within the house's structure. He had hidden a lot about himself in his life. On April the 10th, 1979, once all the work was complete, the house was demolished, which signaled the end of one of the worst serial killer cases in American history. The property stood vacant for several years and, oddly enough, nothing seemed to grow there, not weeds, grass, or anything else. Four bodies were recovered from the Des Plaines River within 6 miles downstream from the bridge that Gacy had thrown them from. The fifth that Gacy claimed to have discarded in the river was never found. Identification of 33 bodies proved to be incredibly difficult, with 6 still unidentified today. Most were identified through dental records, identification cards, and personal items found in Gacy's home, descriptions of scars and tattoos from family members who had reported them missing, and X-ray charts. One victim had been stabbed to death. 13 had died of asphyxiation. Most had died of strangulation. Many still with a rope around their necks when their remains were found. And some deaths could not be determined due to severe decomposition. Some remains were found with underwear, paper, and other items lodged in their throats, and prescription medicine bottles and towels in their rectal area. Some heads and torsos had been wrapped in plastic, and when detectives later asked Gacy about it, he said that it was to stop any leakage, nosebleeds and fluid leakage, especially because he kept some of the corpses in his bed, under his bed, in his closet, or in the attic for approximately 24 hours before burying them. Only 27 victims were ever conclusively identified. 25 were identified by 1986, while 2 were only identified in 2011 when families came forward for DNA analysis and comparison. 6 victims remain unidentified. Some have speculated that their family members may be too afraid to know the truth about what happened to them, preferring to believe that they ran away and are living happy and successful lives. Trial. On March 16th, 1979, when Gacy had been indicted on 7 murder charges, DNA samples were taken from him to prepare for the trial. On April 23rd, 1979, John Wayne Gacy was indicted on 26 additional murder charges, which took his total to 33. On January 28, 1980, the jury selection took place. There were 12 jurors, which included 7 men and 4 women, plus 4 alternates. Their ages ranged from 21 to 71. They had all been selected from Rockford, Winnebago County, because press coverage of the case had been minimal there. The trial commenced on February the 6th, 1980, in the Cook County Criminal Court Building in Illinois, before Judge Louis Garipo, and lasted 5 weeks before Gacy was sentenced on March 13th, 1980. In the year preceding the trial, he had spent more than 300 hours with psychiatrists, who needed to ensure that he was mentally competent to stand trial. At that point, there was no question that he was guilty. He had confessed to the police on 3 separate occasions, had drawn a map of where the bodies were buried in the crawl space, and marked the spot where he had buried a body in his garage. The question was he sane at the time of his crimes? director of the Psychiatric Institute of the County Circuit Court, Dr. Robert Reifman, concluded that Gacy understood the charges against him and was mentally fit to stand trial. The seven-story building buzzed with reporters and spectators as the courtroom filled up, which had 50 seats reserved for the press and several rows of seats for family members and friends of Gacy's victims. The defense attorneys were Sam L. Amarante, lead defense, and Robert Motter, who sat with their client, John Wayne Gacy, and the prosecuting attorneys included William Kunkel, lead prosecutor, Terry Sullivan, and Robert Egan. At the time, first-degree murder could not result in capital punishment under Illinois law, but multiple murders, along with other offenses, could, and Gacy had committed 33 murders, along with aggravated kidnapping, deviant sexual assault, and taking indecent liberties with a minor. Capital punishment was also only reinstated in Illinois in 1974, which meant that the prosecuting team could only seek the death penalty for the 12 murders that he had committed after that date. Gacy's defense team argued in favor of the insanity defense and focused on the abuse that he had suffered at the hands of his father and the consequences it had on his mental health. Psychologists on their team discussed his disorders, which included paranoid schizophrenia and the possibility of dissociative identity disorder, which was called multiple personality disorder at the time. If they could win an insanity plea, it would earn Gacy a sentence in a psychiatric institution instead of the death sentence he was facing. The problem was, if he was able to demonstrate recovery while treated there, the possibility of him being released back into society existed, which posed a risk on the safety of future teenagers' lives. The prosecuting team highlighted Gacy's premeditated actions that demonstrated his sanity at the time of his crimes. For example, hiring teenagers to pre-dig the graves for him and covering the area with lime. They questioned 60 witnesses over 13 days, which included some of Gacy's previous employees. They painted a particularly sinister picture of a sexual predator whose advances they frequently had to conquer. They also interviewed emotional family members and friends of the victims, as well as a panel of psychologists, who served as expert witnesses of Gacy's sanity, mental health, personality, and behavior. The prosecution rested their case on February the 20th, and the following day, the defense commenced theirs. They first questioned Jeffrey Rignall, one of the victims who had survived Gacy in December 1977. Their aim was to demonstrate that Gacy was a very disturbed man who deserved the insanity defense. Rignall described how Gacy had picked him up in his car, knocked him out with chloroform, sadistically raped and tortured him over several hours, almost drowned him in his bathtub, and then dropped his unconscious body off in a Chicago park. Rignall was so traumatized by retelling his experience that he vomited, cried, went hysterical, and had to be escorted out of the room. The defense also interviewed Gacy's mother and sister to offer insight into the abuse that he was forced to endure with his father as a child, and how watching his father physically assault his mother when he was just 2 years old would have likely affected him psychologically. 22 witnesses were interviewed by the defense in total, which included 6 psychologists who testified as medical experts that Gacy was not sane at the time of his crimes. On several occasions, Gacy told the judge that he did not know what was happening and seemed to be dissociating or putting on his best act for the entire courtroom to see. On March the 7th, Judge Garipa reconfirmed that he was fit to stand trial and the case continued. Closing arguments from both the prosecution and defense teams were heard on March 11th. The defense remained firm in their insanity plea, while the prosecutors demonstrated that Gacy was, according to psychiatric experts who analyzed him in 1968, when he was first arrested, always going to be a menace to society. He had been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder a decade earlier, where his diagnosis showed that he would not have benefited from any treatment and had an insatiable, deviant sexual appetite with little regard for human life. Kunkel's closing statement was the final nail in the coffin, where he said, "Show the same sympathy this man showed when he took these lives and put them there." As he said this, he tossed a pile of photos of the victims' faces into the trapdoor that was once the entrance to Gacy's crawl space. It had been on display throughout the trial as evidence. On March the 12th, the jury deliberated the case and unanimously concluded after only 2 hours that the verdict was guilty. On March 13th, the same jury was asked to consider the sentence, which took only 2 hours and 15 minutes to conclude. Death. John Wayne Gacy was sentenced to death on March 13th, 1980. He received 12 death sentences for the murders committed after 1977, and his execution was set for the 2nd of June 1980. At the time, Gacy was the most prolific serial killer in the United States history, with 33 confirmed murders. He was sent to Menard Correctional Center to serve his time on death row before being executed.